This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan and Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum, basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan & Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully, everybody's been doing well. I've been running an excavator all day. I put in a pond today, and quite a bit of work. A lot of planning went into this particular pond. This area is up on a hillside, so on the top of a hillside adjacent to one of my food plots, and I have a ram pump positioned about 130 to 150 feet below this particular area. So there's a pretty good flowing stream, and this ram pump, without any electricity, is pushing it up to this basin that I've dug, and I've had to put in basically a liner in this pond, and hopefully it holds water. We'll see how it goes tomorrow. Tomorrow is day two of figuring this system out, but I've not finalized kind of the way I'm going to figure out the way the water flows out of the pond. I've got a pretty good idea how we're going to do it naturally, and it's just going to kind of gradient along this particular area and flow kind of meandering into another basin where there's going to be a catch point. But I have really good infiltration, so I'm not so concerned with water traveling across the landscape. In fact, I hope it hydrates some of those areas and hopefully changes the vegetation type in and around that particular area. The other thing that I just want to mention, it's really important, is infrastructure, having good roads into these particular areas. I was building a road yesterday into this particular area and making sure that I could get in and out of those areas pretty easily, whether you have to inslope or outslope or crown areas. So it's really important looking at, you know, kind of your first line of movement into a pond to make sure that it's kind of a comfortable grade going into an area. It's just really important to like break down a particular project into these different facets, whether it's moving dirt, you know, figuring out road systems, water catchment, everything to do with kind of infrastructure. Those are really important. The other thing I want to mention, and I think maybe some of you have followed me online, Perry Batten came out with his buddy Adam. They both killed birds in New York. So we had a great turkey hunt. And today, when I started digging, before I turned on the machine, I heard two turkeys gobbling in the center of my property. It's the last day of the season, and it was just awesome to hear, you know, the birds kind of take off, and it's hope for next year, and hopefully they're continuing to breed. We have a good hatch this year, so I'm pretty excited about that. So I've got a brand new guest on, Eric Schellenberg. I'm really excited to have him on. I had a chance to meet him at Ben Falk's event. Ben's been on this podcast. Eric is an absolute wealth of knowledge. He approaches things much different than I think a lot of us. He's got a really interesting background, so we're going to dig into his experience, talk about some of these different ways to look at the landscape and how he approaches you know, some of his farming systems and how that will relate well to your hunting property. Let me get Eric on the line. Hey, Eric, how you been?
Good. Yeah, it sounds like you had a busy day out there building a pond, huh?
Yeah, busy day. It's fun running an excavator.
There's always more that goes into it than you think at the beginning. Doesn't matter how many times you've done it, for sure.
Yeah, I agree. That's a very, very true. And again, you know, I was struggling with that ram pump for weeks and weeks and weeks. I had it running, and then it wouldn't run. And a lot of it has to do with just the right amount of, I just want to say, you know, drive or flow into that pump, that consistency. Yeah. You almost have to tune them, almost like a musical instrument. So, you know, there's definitely some technical kind of focus in getting that to work well, but I got it working great. So we're pumping around 1200 gallons a day, and you know, that's pretty good, especially going up 150 feet in vertical elevation.
Oh, that's significant. So, yeah, that's
absolutely. Great. So Erica, I want you to introduce yourself, talk a little bit about maybe some of your background at a high level. And then I wanted to get into kind of your farming system. And I think some of it has to do, we can get into centropic or agroforestry, but something, some of this has to do with maybe getting away from chemicals. Not that, you know, we don't use chemicals at times, but getting away from chemicals, maybe kind of a more naturalist kind of mindset. And I think that's maybe a good way to kind of explain it to maybe some of the listenership. So let's get into your background.
Yeah. So as far as it pertains to land management, I grew up in a suburban area, but we spent a lot of time in the country, and we had gardens, and my parents grew up on more rural and kind of farming background. So it was always like in the mix. And then when I went to right after I went to college for biology. So I studied biology and ecology and genetics. And then I randomly went down to Mexico, and I met a family there, which I stayed with them for a summer, and they were indigenous people. And I learned a lot from them, and they practiced sort of a traditional system of agroforestry. People have heard of the Milpa system. And it basically, you know, we have this idea of crop rotation, where we think of grains and legumes and pasture and vegetables and whatever. And I can kind of characterize the Milpa system as like a, you know, multi-decade, even, you know, 50-year crop rotation that involves, it's a really sophisticated understanding of ecology and natural succession, and how, you know, they begin a crop cycle with the, you know, corn, beans, and squash, and then the other plants come in, and then it turns into a banana plantation with coffee underneath, and then lumber trees, and then avocados and mangoes, and then cacao, and all this kind of stuff. And so it's like a really long-term evolving system, but the whole thing is managed. So it's sort of like, you know, when you hear people say food forest or something like that, you know, these are some of the original systems that stuff came from. And so I was very curious about learning how that kind of thinking maybe had been used in temperate climates before. And it turns out there's a huge history of that in Europe and Eastern Europe and in South America that has temperate climates. So there's a lot of that can be applicable to our region. And then I became a more normal organic vegetable farmer. So I farmed between 10 and 15 acres of organic vegetables for, I farmed at first. I had, like a 2-acre CSA, and that was in a different spot. We were leasing in a different spot. And then, finally bought this place that I'm on now, 11 years ago. And yeah, we got up to 10, 15 acres at the biggest. And I didn't like the systems that I was using. Because of the scale that I was at and labor costs and all of that, we were sort of forced into the same way of growing that everybody else grows, which is the same model that chemical growers use, which is, you know, because we used organic certified chemicals. So we would use pesticide sprays that were certified. I used organic herbicides. So we had, you know, different kind of soaps that we could use and vinegars, and they're much more expensive, but we still use them. Even tried flame weeding for a little bit and black plastic. And I disliked all of that. And I ended up saying, you know, I really have to get away from this. This is not what I envisioned. And so I had also been planting, you know, tree systems from the beginning, but that was sort of not, I didn't consider that to be the main economic future of the farm. It was kind of hard for me to imagine how that would have worked at the time, because growing vegetables in a monoculture is already hard enough, basically. So why would I try to make it more complicated? So that's where I was at for a while. And then when we ditched some of the chemicals and we ditched the plastic, I was forced to try to think of, okay, how, if I'm not going to till all the time and cultivate, then I need to be able to grow my own mulch, because buying mulch and putting it on 10 acres is just, it's a non-starter. So I started looking into systems of growing your own mulch, and it reminded me of this guy that I had heard, this guy, Aaron Skutch, who does, he created Syntropic Agriculture. And I remembered that he did a lot with growing his own mulch, and that was part of his system. And so I kind of like delved back into that and started applying it. And from there, I ended up gaining a deeper understanding of what his systems were, to the point that I was so intrigued that I found a way to contact him. I went down and learned from him in Brazil. And then I was lucky enough to host him up here in New York in March, which I guess was the first time he had ever come and worked in the States. And we went around to like 6 different farms, and I just learned a ton more about how he would apply, how he would approach applying his concepts in our climate for a wide variety of purposes. So, and now basically I'm just going full steam ahead, applying those principles to my work here, which we can get into what those principles are. But I guess that'll cover the introduction.
Yeah, no, it's a great introduction. And one thing you didn't mention is, where are you located?
Right. Important. So I'm in Highland, New York. It's basically southern Ulster County, or middle Ulster County. So we're, for people not from New York, we're like a 2-hour drive north of New York City or so, or an hour south of Albany. And we're, it's a growing zone 6B or so, 6A or 6B. And we're like, I think 3 miles west of the Hudson, which actually has a big impact on our climate. So we have this kind of funky climate where we have, I was surprised to find this, that one of the climate systems of measuring climates is called the Köppen climate system, K-O-P-P-E-N. And it tells you a lot more than just the USDA. It's a very good one to learn about if you don't know about it already. And the Köppen climate system describes my particular area as humid subtropic summer. So that's how hot we get. We get really hot, really humid. We have many days over 90, many days over 95. And then, you know, but still with a substantial, you know, 6A or 6B. We're right on the cusp of 6A or 6B winter, where we get down to, you know, we'll get down to minus 10 at the coldest. So cold winter, a lot of humidity, and we get about between 40 and 60 inches of rain.
So a fair amount of rain. The other thing, mm-hmm. you mentioned Ernst had come out, and you know, you had a chance to work with him previously, but he came out to New York, which I want to dig into that a little bit.
Yeah.
But you mentioned the term syntropic, and I guess an alternative way to think about that is, rather than separating crops, and I think you'll get into this, crops, mm-hmm. trees, the soil management's a piece of this. It's kind of combining those into kind of a layering system.
Yeah.
Where the ecosystem itself is constantly in regeneration mode. I think I've mentioned a bunch of this, you know, and these are pieces I took from you, trying to reorganize portions of our property, kind of be naturally functioning. And I'm doing this on my own personal property. I kind of, when I saw you this, this winter, I guess it was early spring, you know, I try to explain to you, I'm going down this road that you're going down as well. And I'm mirroring some of the things that I have learned through you. So I think would make the most sense is maybe explaining some of the things you recently learned from Ernst in New York, and then how you took some of the concepts that you've learned over time and are applying them in your system, in your farming system and context.
And we can definitely, I have some ideas about how this pertains specifically to deer and, you know, management for wildlife and that kind of thing, that we can get into later on, because I really do believe that there is a direct link to this kind of approach and management and how many deer can be supported and how interested they are in a particular area. So when Ernst was here, we had a few different goals. One of them was to do an actual, set up a research trial. So this was, the research trial in question was comparing a normal kind of, standard-ish way of growing vegetables in New York compared with a different, completely different model of growing vegetables that is based on trees, or I should say, natural or ecological succession and, high density tree planting, stratified high density tree planting being the driver of fertility, to furnish enough fertility for the production of vegetables. And we all know that vegetables are very hungry crops. It's not like growing grass for, you know, for hay or something like that. These are plants that need 70, 80, 100, 120 pounds of nitrogen per acre, to get a decent crop. And that's not something that, is easy to come by without using any inputs. And so, I can talk about that a little bit later if that's interesting, but there were a few other farms, that we visited where Ernst tackled a wide number of issues. So one had, livestock, they had sheep, they had poultry, they had, I think they were going to switch to cattle at some point, but for the time being they had sheep, and they had a vegetable operation, and they had tree fruit, and they had fodder trees, and they were sort of combined in a way that didn't quite maximize or optimize the benefits from one to the other. And so the idea there, and Ernst came up with a way to tweak how all of those elements interacted to maximize, or to, optimize how all of those different elements work together in a more, could work together in a more functional way. And then there was a big chestnut operation that did silvopasture in between, and they wanted to create a system that would be less prone to pests and diseases and potentially have other production capacity to produce other crops. And I think, I mean, there's so many things that I learned, but it does really always come back down to the principles. And the principles, I would say that the second order principles are that ecological succession and forest stratification need to be understood and addressed anytime we design any biological system. And they can be done poorly, they can be done really well, but if we don't think about them at all, we definitely won't do a good job. And especially if we're designing long-term stuff that that includes trees, we need to understand what strata the tree wants to be in. Does it need to be in full sun, partial shade, deep shade? At what part of its life cycle does it need those different levels of shade? And then succession. What role does a plant have in succession? Where should it be? Where is it? And where does it do well and where does it not do well? And so those, I said, are second order principles, because I consider that the first order principles are, it's a different way of looking at ecosystems. So, the concept, for example, of competition between plants it will only make sense if you look at an ecosystem as a group of different species that are all in it for themselves, fighting amongst themselves, and only cooperating when it benefits themselves. And then they stop cooperating the second it's not of benefit. So that's the classic way that almost all of us have learned to conceive of the ecosystem. And I think part of the reason why Ernst's work was so appealing to me and kind of easy for me to get on board with was that I already had felt a similar way to what he describes about ecosystems, which is I read a lot of Lynn Margulis and many authors that look at ecosystem more as a whole. And so we would never look at a person's body and say, this organ is just fighting for nutrients with that organ, and this muscle is competing with that muscle. You know, it doesn't make any sense if you look at a whole being all as one. Even if you look into a cell and you see molecules destroying one another, you don't say, oh, those molecules are competing for resources. It makes no sense if you know that the whole thing is one big functional unit. And when you look at an ecosystem as one big functional unit where natural ecological succession is constantly improving every place, which it is, that's an undeniable fact, then it begins to seem as though every part of the ecosystem is simply playing its role the best it can. And if it's what's needed to do a certain thing, it thrives. And if it is no longer needed, it begins not to thrive, and then it is retired from the system.
Eric, this is a pretty complex starting point, I think, for a lot of people that might be listening to this podcast. You mentioned cooperation, plants cooperating more than competing with each other. I think most people would think of the focus on monocrops, corn, beans, those type of scenarios where they're planting a singular plant. Now, we're talking a complex forest stand with multiple strata in different classes, species type classes. But at the same point, each plant is doing something in function, whether it's, nitrogen fixing crops, or it's deep rooted, it's creating shade. You know, maybe it's, pollination, whatever it's doing, it's got a function. So when you're looking at the forest in and of itself, every plant is doing something. And one of the goals is biodiversity, a lot of different plants. But you mentioned the term high density, density planting. And this is part of that cooperation rather than competition. But there's maybe weeding of the garden, and so to speak, when you have a lot of trees in concert. And trees will weed out other trees. And so I think what you're getting at is there's a lot of different tree selections that you could potentially make, or in this case, let's say we're working with the forest stand, you might be removing some trees, promoting other species. But one of the goals is to try to get a lot of trees working in synergy, so to speak, fixing some of the deficits, because the plants are potentially fixing the limitations or the problems that may persist in the ecosystem. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about high density planting, how you look at a forest stand, so to speak, in this multi-strata or multi-layer perspective, and just maybe break that down for maybe the listenership.
Yeah. So I think everybody on this podcast would be very interested in eventually creating forest stands that have huge mass production. And so that could be planting nut trees, chestnuts, oak trees. It could be planting persimmons, many different apples, all kinds of things, many different things that would be excellent food for wildlife and for people. And that we can break plants down in to two broad categories. And this is a little bit artificial, but it will make sense for this purpose. on the one hand, we have plants that produce a ton of biomass, and they produce a ton of nutrition for the soil. And then we have plants that take from the soil and create masts, and that can be fruit or nuts or whatever. And those two groups of plants are very different in a lot of ways. And this, as you can tell, crosses plant families, all kinds of boundaries. And so the idea is that if you have a poor soil or a soil that isn't very well developed biologically, or a stand that has low biodiversity, or maybe you see this kind of classic picture of overstocked and there's a lot of so-called invasive species and the soil is kind of bare and there's not a lot of leaf litter and it just looks like an unhealthy system. What people are inclined to do is to get rid of the undesirable species to the best that they can, clear the space out, plant in the desirable species, and then do everything they can to make sure that the desirable species thrive and succeed. And this is not the best model because these areas need soil building first so that those tree species that we want can survive and thrive without any of the help that we're accustomed to giving them. So let me explain this. Think of poplar trees. Well, deer do love to eat poplar stems, but poplars do not make any fruit. They make a tiny, tiny little seed, and it's no good for any large animals. But poplar trees, willow trees, alder trees, and a few others, the so-called soft hardwoods, they are able to feed the soil huge amounts of exudates, and that keeps the soil life alive. And when the soil life gets all of that sugar and other molecules from these plants, they are then able to share them with the plants that really need a lot, which is these fruiting crops. And so without that cooperation, I mean, it's a simplistic idea, but in a sense, the hardy pioneer trees are kind of the givers or the creators to the soil life. And the other ones are sort of the outlet of excess energy in the soil goes into the mast. And so what I could say is that a particular stand of trees will not be able to produce good quality mast or almost any mast at all unless the metabolic needs of the soil life is satisfied. So if the soil life isn't getting a lot of exudates from a lot of fast-growing, vigorous trees, then they're not going to give the conditions to the fruiting trees to make their fruit or their nuts. And in fact, they will actively prevent any trees there from making mast by bringing diseases to them or bringing plagues of insects and all kinds of things. And so we think of insects and diseases as some kind of somewhat random. It comes in, it gets my oak this year or it got my persimmon this year. But in fact, the soil life and even the tree itself make the avenue open to that pathogen to prevent the tree from producing fruit. And that is a direct function of how well the soil is being fed by exudates. And so if we were to, instead of planting just a row of chestnuts or persimmons or the fruit trees that we're most interested in, if we were to densely plant in 5 or 10 of these fast-growing, vigorous trees for every fruit tree, and then we were to prune those fast-growing trees in a certain way every once in a while, we would create better conditions for those trees to fruit well. And we wouldn't need as much or any fencing. That's how I use no deer fencing, and I have a high deer population. We would need no fertilizers. We would need no pest and disease sprays or anything like that. And so that's, I think, the biggest take home is to create, to use those early pioneer species to really build the soil and build the conditions for the trees that we want to thrive.
That's a pretty interesting concept. And I've kind of introduced this briefly on this podcast, so hopefully some of the listeners understand the points you're trying to make here, because I think they're pretty different than most people, because in most instances, people are thinking, amend the soil, spray a foliar, you know, do whatever they can to increase the functionality, the productivity, what have you, of the trees that they're trying to promote, whether it's crabapple trees, pears, persimmons, etc. That being said, plants synergistically work together. You mentioned one thing that was kind of interesting, pruning trees, an intense pruning style. I know that's a big piece of this. And then part of this is also layout. You know, how do you include, you know, some of these large, I guess, I shouldn't say large, but biomass or trees like willows, et cetera, that you can prune using some of that material, and in concert, having them in kind of these forest stands where they're easily accessible, you can use the material. How intensely or often do you prune some of these trees? You know, some of the species you're talking about, I mean, do you cut them right to the ground? Do you, you know, what's the philosophy and strategy of planting trees? And I want you to hit on, like, in these examples, you know, real life scenario, I've actually seen this happen without actually understanding it, where I've seen a apple tree in, I have not pruned the apple tree whatsoever, adjacent to a poplar tree. And that particular relationship seems to be well enough that those trees are thriving compared to trees that are planted singular on their own. And it's made me reevaluate placements of trees in the landscape in concert to other trees and what specific light condition or position they should be on the landscape. I think some of these fruit producing trees may not need to be in wide open spaces like you might think. And so it's made me kind of like relook at my landscape. So I want you to go back to the, you know, how do you integrate these, you know, pioneer species into these plantings? How do you prune them? And then, you know, what are the things that you're seeing, just an observation that you think is relevant for the listeners?
So as far as pruning, there's no one simple answer, but first thing is to evaluate how much time you have and what you want to get out of it. Because I'll lay out two different ideas here. First of all, let's say you're really interested in the mass production, you're interested in the fruit, and maybe you could be convinced to plant some other trees in between them if it was going to increase the vigor and the health of your fruit trees, but you don't want to do any more work than you have to. Completely understandable. And so maybe your fruit trees are going to be 15 feet apart or whatever. You have a row of trees and they're going to have some distance between them. If you would plant three trees in between each one of those, so you've got 15 feet and you plant three, 15 feet between pear trees, and you put three willows or poplars in between those two pear trees. At the time of planting, you plant them all. The willows take over the space much quicker than the pears. And you could even put some nitrogen fixing shrubs in there. And after 3 years, the willows maybe have some branches entering into the crown of the pear trees. And so you would just go through at some point and cut those. You could just cut them to the ground, the two, and leave the one willow in the center. And then another few years go by, and then the willow in the center is having branches entering the crowns of the pear trees, and then you could cut that one out. And even that, with almost no management over the time, I mean, it's very, very little management. You just come through with a chainsaw and thin out the excess. That really replicates what would happen in a natural stand. And in the meantime, those willows or poplars would have done an enormous amount of soil building, and the pear trees or whatever fruit it is will receive a huge benefit from all of that. And then on top of that, the rotting wood and the mulch, huge benefits. And of course, you could fell them at different times of the year, depending if you want to give the deer some browse in the wintertime, you can fall them in the winter. And then the deer love to come in and eat the buds because there's not that, sometimes there's not that much food for them. And then the willow buds are one of their favorite foods in the wintertime. But really any tree, if you bring the crown down in the middle of the winter, any tree, they will love it. So you could thin them that way. And then, so that's a very small amount of additional work, especially with those species that you could plant as live stakes. Some people say, well, I don't want to do all that extra planting. If you plant, you know, if you're planting grafted fruit trees or nut trees, and then you just include live stakes, you know, 2-3 foot length of a willow branch, you just stick in the ground, virtually all of them root. It's just a super fast planting. It's a really easy way to build the soil life and to have a huge benefit for your fruit trees. And I would recommend nitrogen fixing shrubs because, you know, commercial fruit growers, they put a lot of nitrogen on their fruit trees. They drip nitrogen at least 2-3 times a week, 50 ppm, 100 ppm nitrogen. When fruit trees are young, real commercial growers push them very hard with nitrogen because they want to fill their row up as fast as possible. The only way to achieve that without synthetic fertilizers or organic fertilizers or manures.
Thanks for listening to part one. Part two, we get into more detail on building soil fertility, how to produce more deer browse, generating hard mass, improving long-term forest productivity. I hope you appreciate the information that's in this particular podcast. Eric is a wealth of knowledge, and these new design concepts are a bit revolutionary for anyone, I believe, that's doing this type of work in our temperate climate that really is looking to improve their forest stands for productivity and deer interest. We'll talk next week. See ya.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.